Good morning. I now call this remote hearing of the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order, and we will take the roll.
Chair Long.
Present.
Vice Chair Akam.
Present.
Minority Lead Swazinski.
Here.
Representative Bierman.
Present.
Representative Bowe.
Present.
Representative Christensen.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Grunhagen.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hornstein.
Present.
Representative Igo.
Igo, present.
Representative Lee.
Lee, present.
Representative Lippert.
Lippert, present.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, present.
Representative Mecklund.
Mecklund, present.
Representative Munson.
Munson, present.
Representative Stevenson. Representative Stevenson.
Members, we have a quorum. So we have a really interesting informational hearing today. Members will be hearing first from some presentations from the insurance industry on the impacts of climate change. And then we will be taking a break for questions. And we will hear presentations on the benefits of a net zero energy transition, as well as how to take into account climate change cost impacts into decision-making as policymakers. So a full day today, and we'll begin by welcoming Peter Brickwedy from the Department of Commerce. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Peter Brickwedy, Assistant Commissioner at the Commerce Department. I'm very excited to be with you today and to kick off this section of the agenda. I'll be brief in my opening remarks, but I want to convey that the department hopes that this is the first of many opportunities to bring our agency's full range of perspective on climate issues into the committee's view. Simply put, the effects and costs of our changing climate permeate the work of our entire agency. In addition to the work of Commerce's Division of Energy Resources, which I think the committee's most familiar with, Commerce is also Minnesota's insurance, financial services, and financial institutions regulator. And because Commerce works with consumers and businesses operating across all of these economic sectors, the department knows how vital a role insurance plays in Minnesotans' ability to build resiliency, reduce risk, and mitigate the effects of extreme weather and our changing climate. Extreme weather events have long been a significant contributing factor to rising insurance costs in our state. Minnesota frequently appears on the annual top 10 list of the nation's most expensive weather-related events. But for consumers to rely on insurance coverage when they need it, the insurance industry has to prepare for the economic risks of our changing climate every single day. From increasing claims payouts to policyholders due to more frequent severe storms, to investment decisions that keep insurance companies solvent, climate risk hits both sides of insurers' balance sheets. I'm happy that you're going to be hearing shortly from Allianz so that members can hear directly about the challenges and opportunities that climate risks present to an insurer, and particularly a local one here with their North American operations based in Minnesota. And I would also say that insurance regulators like the Commerce Department across the country are hard at work upgrading and improving our oversight and disclosure tools to help insurers and consumers reduce their risk exposure to catastrophic losses. I'm excited for you to learn a little bit about that work today. As the state's insurance regulator, we are a member of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, or NAIC. Commerce has long been a member of NAIC's climate-related work, which a couple of years ago was elevated and prioritized through the creation of an executive-level task force. To tell you more about the NAIC's specific areas of focus within the climate space, I'd like to introduce my colleague, Jennifer Gardner. Jennifer is a manager in the NAIC's regulatory services area and staffs the NAIC Climate Task Force and its work streams. I'm happy to stand for questions at the end, but otherwise I'll turn it over to Jennifer.
Ms. Gardner, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Representative Long, my name is Jennifer Gardner, and I'm the Property and Casualty Regulatory Services Manager for the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. As Peter mentioned, so this we were formed in 1871 to assist state insurance regulators by providing a forum for discussion, setting standards and best practices, providing regulators with support functions, and coordinating regulatory support. The NAIC began hearing presentations on climate impacts back in the 90s under the Property and Casualty Insurance Committee, They formed a working group in 2005 and developed a set of questions to ask insurers about their climate risk exposure back in 2009, which Minnesota has been participating in for several years. So that's what Peter had mentioned earlier with the climate risk disclosure. And then in 2020, the NAIC moved the climate and resiliency work under its executive task or executive committee and named it a top priority. This drew in additional members and gave the topic more focus and attention. So today we have 44 members and leadership across all states and territories. And when the task force was formed, the leadership created 5 work streams to support their goals. So I'll walk through each of these 5 work streams in a little more detail. The pre-disaster mitigation work stream is focused on mitigation actions that can reduce the risk of loss to both property and loss of life before disasters occur. So FEMA and state emergency management agencies have been focused on rebuilding and assisting people after disasters strike. We think it's important to shift the focus to what can be done before events occur to avoid losses and allow people to recover faster. This also helps with the insurance issues where, you know, if you don't have to pay out the losses, there's less solvency risk. And then also it just benefits consumers. So the pre-disaster mitigation work stream has held several workshops and meetings with a focus around 5 key themes. The first is risk assessment and coordination. Very few insurance departments actually have resiliency offices within their department. Many states have a chief resiliency office, and all states have emergency management agencies. So coordination among risk agencies is critical, and information is necessary to identify high-risk areas within the state. Once hazards have been identified, proper land use planning and construction standards can go a long way in making sure the built environment can withstand the perils most common to that area. So we've held discussions and presentations from the International Code Council about the building code development and adoption process. Several states have been actively participating in the building code process within their state. And then, however, you know, building codes are only for new construction. So a vast majority of the building stock is already built. And we've been working with the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety. IBHS has a lab in Richmond, South Carolina, where they test construction materials and building components for their resilience to various perils. IBHS created the Fortified program to identify structural elements that make a home more resilient to hurricane force winds and rain. And then due to increasing loss from wildfire within the past year, IBHS has also developed a wildfire planned home and wildfire planned community. And then most recently, they developed a multifamily construction in the aftermath of the Surfside collapse in Florida. So IBHS has all this great knowledge of how to make buildings and homes more resilient, but then nothing happens if people don't actually implement the changes within the built environment and improve their circumstances. And they're not likely to do that if they don't know what their risk is or have the money to make the improvements. And that's where the State Department of Insurance really comes in. Most states do identify hazards common to the region, and they conduct consumer outreach on various perils. You know, usually ahead of a storm season, they're pushing out material to their consumers and constituents. Many states have a mitigation program where they can identify common hazards and vulnerabilities in the building stock of certain regions in the state, and then provide grant funds to homeowners to make improvements. The insurance industry has participated in these as well and contributed funding. So Alabama, North Carolina, and South Carolina have mitigation programs for fortified roofs. California has California Earthquake Authority, which provides funding to improve resiliency for structural components to withstand earthquake events. Mm-hmm. And then insurance companies can provide discounts to homeowners who make improvements to their property, reducing the risk of loss. And state governments can create incentive programs through tax savings accounts and tax credits for mitigation actions. Some states eliminate the sales tax on building materials that are purchased to improve a property's resilience to common perils. And then, so our next work stream is the climate risk disclosure. And that was developed back in 2009 to assess insurers' climate-related risks. We're in the process of updating that today so we can better align with the Financial Stability Board's Task Force on Climate-Related Disclosure. This is a reporting mechanism that's growing in popularity internationally. And I just saw the announcement this morning that the SEC is supposed to expose their new climate disclosure for publicly traded companies later this week, maybe even tomorrow. The solvency workstream is reviewing regulatory tools like the financial exam handbook to determine what states should be asking insurers with regard to their climate risk. The exam process is conducted by states to ensure that companies remain in good financial standing and have the money to pay claims. The workstream is also considering how to measure insurers' exposure to climate risk in their investment portfolios. And last year, they did that on a national level, just taking a look at what climate exposed investments the industry had currently. And then we have two additional workstreams. We have the innovation workstream, which is looking at insurance products and their ability to close the protection gap, which is created when insurers pull back from markets based on repeat losses. And, you know, to improve their solvency condition, sometimes they'll just exit the market, but there are innovative tools that insurance companies can create to help eliminate the coverage gap. And then on the technology front, we're focused on tools that can help understand and evaluate the risk. So the workstream developed a proposal for the NASD to create a catastrophe model center of excellence, which would help develop education and training on catastrophe models and provide a forum for the regulators to share information about what's being filed in their states. So we are having a meeting on March 21st to adopt or to consider for adoption those two items, the survey and the Catastrophe Model Center of Excellence. And then we'll actually be hosting a meeting in Kansas City. This is the first time in, I think, 20 years. We've had one in Kansas City, but on April 6th, we'll hear presentations from Zurich and Resilient Cities Network. They teamed up to do some flood mitigation in Boston and Houston. So that project is just kind of kicking off, but we're going to hear about what they've got going on there. And then they've got three additional cities scoped out for future work. And then Munich Re has worked on flood resilience along the Missouri River. So a few years ago, we had a lot of flooding along the Missouri River, and they worked with Building Code of Engineers and the Nature Conservancy to try to identify some mitigation measures along that river. So that is it, Mr. Chairman. I am happy to yield the floor back to you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Gardner. Next, we'll be hearing from Diane Gates with Allianz Life Insurance. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. I think you're on mute, Ms. Gates.
Let me try that again.
We can hear you now.
Members of the committee, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to speak to you today. So I'm Diane Gates. I am the Chief Administrative Officer of Allianz Investment Management US, which is an investment subsidiary of Allianz Life here locally in Minneapolis. Also an assistant vice president at Allianz Life and have been there for over 25 years. I'm an actuary by training and have had a variety of roles in actuarial finance and investments. All right, so first off, I wanna give you a little bit of context about Allianz. We are not so much of a household name here in the US. And want to just make sure you've got a little bit of context on us. So we are a very large global financial services company. We cover property casualty, life and health, and asset management. And really pleased for the opportunity to speak today. Climate change is an extremely important topic to us, basically covering all of those lines of business, as you will see. So here locally, so as I mentioned, work for Allianz Life Insurance Company of North America and their investment sub. We've been around for quite some time. Locally, you will know us probably most through the Allianz Field, which is, of course, the home and the stadium of the local professional soccer team. So first, I want to kind of set the stage. So for Allianz, how we look at ESG, and first for context, in case that's not an acronym you're familiar with, ESG standing for environmental, social, and governance, really is a synonymous with sustainability. So we look at this holistically. I will get into the climate and the environment aspect, but just want to set the context. So for us as Allianz, we look at it primarily through kind of two different sets of lenses. One, there are the 17 UN Sustainable Development Goals that were drafted up in 2015. For those not familiar, and if you can't really read the slide, just a little bit of a flavor, things like no poverty, quality education, gender equality, and then of course there are climate-related items with affordable and clean energy, sustainable cities and communities, and climate action. So that's one frame of reference we come to this work from, and then given our four very different roles, we are lenses on this. So for us as an insurer, obviously, as Jennifer talked about, you know, especially on the property casualty side, climate change is a very significant risk, but a lot of the risks that we are insuring. So being part of the solutions here is super important. Also, as an investor, attracting employees, and then generally overall as a global corporate citizen. So I come, as I've mentioned, from the investment side, and here locally as a life insurer, unlike property casualty, where the risks are, you know, very direct to the insurance we're writing, on the life insurance, it's not so direct. Where it does come into play for us, and this was mentioned previously, is on our other side of our balance sheet with the investment side. So from an investment perspective, we take a very holistic approach and a multifaceted approach. Not going to go through all of the pieces here. I will just highlight a few that I think are probably of most interest and relevance. So there are certain things that we just outright exclude in that we will not invest in certain types of companies. So companies that create and develop cluster bombs, we do not invest in them. More to the environmental side of things, any company that has more than 30% of their revenues coming from coal-based business, we will not invest in them. And we have a commitment that by 2040, that is going to grade down to zero, meaning that after 2040, we will not invest in any company that has a part of coal business. Also, it's important from that we be part of sustainable investments. In order to do the shift to a net zero climate economy, there is a significant amount of investment that's needed. So a couple areas that we focus on, renewable energy. So we invest in hydro, solar, and wind subsectors. And the last piece I'll mention is in the upper left is engagement. So these are conversations that we have directly with investor companies. Our goal is really to understand their company, but also help influence so that they hopefully are doing better disclosure. That obviously is a key topic that's going on. I know Jennifer mentioned that with SEC and the TCFD reporting framework that's being pushed there. But so we wanna encourage that disclosure. More information means better decision-making for all people involved. And then also understanding their business model and are they on a path to transition their business towards a net zero economy, regardless of what sector they operate in. All right. So then diving a little bit more specifically into Allianz's climate change strategy, there's a lot on the slide. I'm just going to make some high level comments in the interest of time, but there's kind of three areas where we really focus. So of course, we're looking to anticipate the risks of changing climate. As I mentioned, we're phasing out coal-based business. And this is not just on the investment side that I mentioned, but also on the insurance side. So as we are no longer, and we actually have already done that on the property casualty side, in that we are no longer insuring coal-based business. Another key topic and part of this overall discussion is caring for climate vulnerable. So this is not just an environmental topic, but it also impacts people. Obviously, this is a very personal and human story. So trying to be part of solutions and being cognizant of those impacts as we move towards net zero. And then last but not least is enabling the low carbon transition. And I touched on this before, is we invest in these low carbon assets where possible, looking at investing in cleaner technology as we move towards that. Ultimately for us, we are setting our long-term climate goals in line with the 1.5 degrees Celsius aligned net zero emission pathway, which is underlying the Paris Accords. And then finally, there's a final bullet here. I'll speak to something that we're really proud of and have been kind of at the forefront of, is Allianz was one of the founding members of what's referred to as the UN convened Net Zero Asset Owner Alliance. This is an international group that has continued to grow since it was launched at the UN Climate Action Week in September 2019, and at this point represents more than 70 institutional investors and represent over $10 trillion of assets under management. So a significant force and ability to impact and influence real world change. So what does this mean? Each of the member companies have made a commitment that our investment portfolios will be net zero from a greenhouse gas emission by 2050. And we are setting intermediate targets every 5 years. Obviously 2050 is a bit out into the future. Action is super important now, and that we make sure that we're tracking towards that. So we've committed to a 25% reduction in the first 5 years. So by year end 2024, our investment portfolio will be reduced by at least 25% in its greenhouse gas emissions. So that concludes my comments, Mr. Chair. Welcome any questions at whatever point's appropriate, but thanks again so much for this opportunity.
Thank you so much, Ms. Gates. And finally, in this section, before we go to questions, we'll be hearing from Eric Giesick, who is with the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm currently a visiting scholar at the University, at the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota. And for the past 2 years, I've been involved with examining the physical risks of climate change and their impacts and costs on the real and financial assets. This work has been conducted with an academic research team at Brookings and through advisory and consulting work to data analytics and modeling firms. This follows a nearly 30-year career in the insurance industry, where I had led actuarial, risk, and underwriting functions with responsibilities for pricing, modeling, and estimating insurance risks, including natural catastrophes. The insurance industry has been on the forefront of providing not only financial security after disasters, but leading efforts to quantify the risks of natural catastrophes and climate change, and incentivizing solutions and behavior through pricing signals and ensuring requirements that mitigate losses. These efforts are critical for the long-term success of the business model, but also generate broader societal benefits through safer environments and create forward-looking solutions for emerging risks that facilitates economic activity by assuming risks that individuals, businesses, and financial markets do not want to take. The insurance industry, through its capabilities and learning, has much to offer in the climate discussion. However, the insurance industry is not the complete solution for dealing with the physical impacts of natural catastrophes and climate change. To put this issue into context, insurers and modeling firms estimate that economic losses for disasters are up to 3 times insured losses. They estimate that average annual economic losses from disasters globally are in excess of $250 billion, with only $100 billion insured, leaving something like $150 billion or more per year to be funded by governments or retained by individuals and companies. In the U.S. alone, the federal funding for disaster assistance from 2005 to 2018 across multiple agencies and programs was $430 billion. The physical impacts of natural catastrophes and climate change will continue to grow and put pressure on the current insurance business model, increase the risk to the valuation of real estate and financial assets, and impact the economies of local and communities most exposed. Climate change has a twofold effect on the hazards themselves. First, it introduces chronic risk hazards into the loss equation, such as sea level rise, increased moisture and precipitation in some areas, and heat waves and droughts in other areas. Second, It is increasingly understood it will exacerbate current acute hazard risks, such as hurricanes, floods, wildfires, and severe storms. Another important aspect is temporal. Whereas in a stable climate, you can build and invest with a degree of confidence of what the physical risks will be over the useful life of the asset. Now, we must assess the physical risk impact on those assets and investments over the investment horizon and useful life of those assets decades into the future. And this leads to a third aspect. Local economies will be affected by choices companies and people make on where to locate and do business, especially as it becomes more certain where the most exposed areas to climate change will be. Given this backdrop, our research team through Brookings looked at why physical risks have not gotten more attention. Our papers, Flying Blind and Inviting Danger, focused on several issues, two of which I will cover briefly. The first is the need for current data and information for investors and also policymakers regarding physical risks of natural catastrophes and climate change. And the second is the incentives, particularly through federal disaster insurance and infrastructure policy, as well as financial disclosure, for providing appropriate market pricing signals and steering investment towards resilient and adaptive solutions. While the insurance industry and natural catastrophe modeling firms have been building capabilities around estimating the cost of natural hazards for decades and applying it to real-world solutions, not much of this knowledge has been leveraged broadly outside the insurance industry until recently. There are two favorable developments that have occurred. The first is advancements in technology have greatly improved the capability to understand the hazard, the exposures, and the vulnerabilities to those exposures to generate loss functions at a very granular level for nearly all residential and commercial assets in the United States. For instance, the state of flood modeling inside and outside of FEMA flood zones to encompass the nuances of topography and understanding water flows provides a far more holistic and comprehensive view of flood exposure than previous FEMA flood maps. The second is a body of work that's tackling the complexities of modeling future climate scenarios and translating that into damage functions through vulnerability, economic, financial, and demographic factors. This work is paving the way for the impact of new hazards such as drought, wetter conditions, and sea level rise so that they can be factored into longer-term investment and policy considerations. In addition, analytic firms are creating the models necessary to estimate costs of hurricanes, wildfires, and floods under climate scenarios decades into the future. Recently, these developments and new techniques have been expanded to create solutions for the real estate and mortgage industries, allowing better understanding for risks for investors. As this information on natural catastrophes and climate is understood and absorbed and used more broadly by investors and market participants, it will impact pricing of assets and cost of capital from residential homes to infrastructure projects and from equities to municipal bonds. However, one critical error we found lacking was an easily accessible and reliable source for an inventory of public infrastructure that could be used to create natural hazard and climate models on par with those that currently exist for private assets. The investment to create such an inventory and models would add huge value for investors and policymakers in understanding the risks going forward in local communities, for investors, and informing the most effective strategies for resilience. Now, turning to the issue of incentives, in the paper Inviting Danger, we looked at individual federal policies and government programs, such as the Federal Disaster Relief Program and the National Flood Insurance Program, according to how they affect the damages associated with climate-related natural disasters, and how these programs provide incentives to mitigate physical impacts of climate change in the future. In effect, we looked across the whole of the federal budget and asked, are those policies building back the same, or are they building back better? What we find is that the federal funding is heavily skewed towards recovery at a rate that is something like 7 times that of resilience. The incentives continue to encourage building back the same in areas likely to get damaged again and developing in those areas most likely to be damaged by climate change in the future. In fact, the most significant driver of the increase in cost of natural disasters to date has been migration and economic concentration to areas most exposed and the urbanization. Layering increased damage functions from climate change only exacerbates the problem. Further, the implied backing of the municipal bonds through disaster funds post events and effectively no disclosure to investors of natural catastrophes and climate risk within those bonds provides little incentive to invest with resilience in mind. Continuing this path only shifts the cost burden to others and into the future. It really doesn't solve the physical risk problem. Given that this problem is national, but experienced on a local level, any solution requires a fit-for-purpose public-private partnership that creates the framework for effective incentives for resilience and appropriate market signals for allocating capital. A core principle to consider is a construct that enables private insurance markets to provide solutions first, with a government backstop second. Insurance markets operate best when moral hazard and adverse selection is minimized or eliminated. Risks can be diversified and funded by investors with positive expected return over time, and insuring agreements and pricing structures that reflect the risk insured and incentivized management practices. The industry has worked with policymakers over time on building codes for flood, fire, and wind to ensure resilience of those assets and continuity of insurability. And these efforts are still ongoing in the new environment. In Minnesota, while we don't worry about hurricanes so much, flood and hail risk are a real concern for urban and rural areas and for the agriculture industry. Working on forward-thinking zoning and building codes with incentives from both insurers and local governments, with more comprehensive flood maps reflecting on-plane and off-plane flood risks, will increase the ability for the private insurance market to offer insurance solutions and the attractiveness of communities. Similarly, hail is a big issue in Minnesota. And if the frequency becomes so high that it threatens affordability or even insurability, addressing building codes for hail-resistant roofing materials is a better option. Natural catastrophes and climate change risk requires preparation now for an ongoing, cost-effective, resilient solution. The costs will eventually be borne by everybody, some more than others, depending on location and preparation. But facilitating private insurance solution in conjunction with effective public policy will reduce the overall costs of what would otherwise occur. Thank you again for the time to speak, Mr. Chairman, and I turn it back to you.
So much, Mr. Giesig. I have one question to begin, and then I see we have a couple of hands as well. So my question is for Mr. Brickwedy. I'm curious from the state's perspective when you're thinking about options that we have for working with insurers and with policyholders.
Panel.
Ms. Gardner, what are some of the options that we can think about in terms of getting ahead of some of the challenges that we know are coming, strengthening and hardening some of our buildings before we know some of the disasters that are increasingly prevalent, and what lessons can we learn from other states?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. I think there are many answers. I'll touch on a couple of highlights. And I think building off of Professor Gesick's last set of comments, I think there's a tremendous amount of value that we could find by looking at updates that work in concert with one another on our energy codes and on our building codes. I think, just generally speaking, and you heard it in sort of the details and how we've oriented federal dollars much more towards recovery than towards resiliency, but that's actually a more expensive long-term solution. And it is less expensive for individual policyholders, for homeowners, for businesses to take steps ahead of a disaster than to rebuild from a disaster. I think we see that in examples across the country with lots of perils, some that we experience here in Minnesota, some that we do not. The state of California, the state of Colorado, other states in the Western United States have taken lots of steps to try to buttress their homeowners markets and to encourage and incentivize property owners to take steps to do wildfire mitigation that can help a home or a structure survive in a wildfire setting. That's not something that to date we've had a lot of issues here in Minnesota with, but the comments earlier about hail damage are certainly something that we have dealt with here. And so incentivizing everyone in the chain, from the property owner all the way to the people who build roofs, to the people who are designing roofs, have the opportunity and the incentive to try to build to that higher standard so that when we do have stronger, more frequent convective storms or extreme weather, that we don't have the same kind of property damage that we've seen before. That's going to be more expensive in the long term for Minnesotans than not. So I think there are a lot of examples like that that really get down to the individual tactical personal choices options, but there's also ways that we can incentivize companies to try to bring innovative products to market. There are lots of states in the Gulf, for example, that have incentives and they're either in their tax structure or other statutory constructions to help insurance companies bring to market products that might help people who live in areas that might be more exposed to flood, more might be exposed to severe storms, make decisions that will help them weather, no pun intended, those events in ways that will prevent them from having to rebuild from scratch.
Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to the testifiers. Fascinating. I mean, this has been a fascinating meeting so far. So thanks to all of you for coming. It's interesting to look at climate change through your eyes, the insurance field's eyes, as you are the professionals at evaluating risk. And so it's been very, very interesting to hear what you're doing. I apologize, but I forgot the name of the testifier for Alliance.
Ms. Gates.
Okay. So I have a question that I'm wondering, you said that the next, or that you, every 5 years you evaluate, right now your net zero goal is at 2050, and that every 5 years you evaluate. And I'm wondering when you evaluated last and when is the next evaluation, if that number will change.
Ms. Gates.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Representative, thanks so much for the question. So the Net Zero Asset Owner Alliance was founded in 2019. So we're actually in our first 5 year period. So we did the evaluation, soon after the Alliance was formed and set this first 5 year target for the 25%. So as we near the end, that ends at year end 2024. So during 2024 and into 2025, that's when we'll have our next evaluation period, assess where we're at and set the target for, at that point, year end 2029.
Senator Christensen.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. And thanks everyone again. Great testimony.
Representative Bacon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to all the speakers. Again, it's fascinating presentations. And my question is about, several of you talked about the damage that we see in Minnesota because of extreme weather, and that's maybe higher than other parts of the country. And also heard testifiers talk about hail damage. And so all of this makes me wonder, is there anyone that's looking at the cost to consumers for insurance is, and the impact for climate change? And so it, for whether that's, you know, homeowners insurance, auto insurance, health insurance, whether that's individuals or businesses, is there, how much more are we paying today for our insurance to make up for all of this? Is that something that's being looked at and evaluated?
Looks like Mr. Brickwetty is interested in jumping in.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Akam, I think that's a really, really important question. I think it's going to differ a little bit company to company, but I think that every line of insurance, the biggest ones being property, casualty, life, and health, all of those lines of insurance are affected by the impacts of climate change. So there is going to be some cost that's sort of baked in over time, and that's because that risk affects both sides of the insurance company's balance sheets. I wouldn't speak to each one individual company. I know the Insurance Federation of Minnesota has long kind of tried to composite some of these costs. I think we typically from the regulatory standpoint are looking at events and what the costs of a specific event are. But those events, as they happen more frequently, are things that actuarially are going to be baked into rates moving forward. And so I do think you'll see you are seeing, Minnesota consumers are seeing cost impacts due to the change in climate. And I think the biggest question then is, what do we do to try to mitigate those risks so that, as we talked about a few minutes ago, consumers can make educated choices, smart choices about how to strengthen and fortify their structures mitigate the prospect of damage, which is going to be more costly to rebuild with over the long run. So we could put together some of those numbers. I don't have them specifically on hand here right now, but get them to you after the hearing is done.
Senator Bacon.
Thank you. I would really just appreciate that follow-up. I just think it's important to be able to point to the increased cost that we are all paying in every premium regarding climate change. And so thank you. I would appreciate that information.
And Mr. Chair. Sure.
Mr. Brickway.
I just add one other coda on that. Ms. Gates spoke about Allianz's participation in a survey or disclosure tool called the TCFD. And that's a tool that the National Association of Insurance Commissioners has been using to reconfigure our longstanding climate risk disclosure survey that Minnesota has been a participant in. Ms. Gardner talked about that in her remarks. We now are up to about 15 states across the country who participate in that survey, but that constitutes about 80% of the national insurance market. So that increased level of disclosure to the public, I think, helps consumers understand what insurance companies are doing to prepare for risks, and also understanding what some of the opportunities might be for both consumers and for the companies to see what is happening across the entire insurance landscape in regard to how people are preparing for climate risk.
Great. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This is a question for Ms. Gardner. You had mentioned the importance of land use, and you also noted the situation in Houston. I believe that was after Hurricane Harvey. If you could talk a little bit more about that, how our development and land use patterns have exacerbated some of the problems that we see with some of these climate-related disasters, and some of your ideas for addressing that issue.
Ms. Gates, was the question?
Jennifer Gardner.
Oh, Ms. Gardner.
She's in another presentation. Yeah.
I'm sorry about that. Mr. Chairman, can you repeat the question?
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Ms. Gardner, you had mentioned the issue of land use. You had also noted the impacts of Hurricane Harvey in Houston. It's long been a concern of mine how our land use and development patterns have exacerbated some of these climate disasters. And I'm wondering if you could elaborate just a little bit on those points you made.
Ms. Gardner.
Yes. Thank you so much for the question, Representative Hornstein. I agree with you. I think that land use planning does play a critical role, and the risk assessment really goes a long way in helping identify where those areas are problematic. And I think as Mr. Jessic had mentioned earlier, a lot of the catastrophe modeling is developed and used by insurance companies, but not necessarily by other entities outside of that network and could be. And I think some of the catastrophe models are starting to turn their focus towards other communities and working with planning and zoning and things of that nature. So I think that's a great way to kind of link the risk assessment with the actual land use planning for future.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Brickwetty.
I'd add, Representative Hornstein, that our colleagues at the Pollution Control Agency, through sort of lead amongst equals through the governor's climate subcabinet, have been working with our federal partners at FEMA on new grant opportunities, particularly the what's called the BRIC grant, the Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communities grant opportunity, which is a new opportunity from FEMA for states to get access to help do flood hazard mitigation that's based in community-based models. So getting at some of the topics I think that you're pointing to in your question. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, PCA also has a legislative proposal as part of the governor's budget to help expand that work as well.
Representative Hornstein.
I appreciate that, and I'd like to stay in the loop with you about those initiatives. Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty.
That's a good follow-up.
Thank you.
Representative Boonhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the testifiers. My question would be for Professor Gesick. Is that pronouncing it right?
Gesick, I believe.
Okay. Anyway, I've got a book here that's been recently written by three eminently qualified scientists. It's called Why Scientists Disagree About Global Warming or Climate Change. It was written by Dr. Itso. He's a climatologist, one of the world's leading experts on the effects of carbon dioxide on plant and animal life. Then it was Dr. Carter, a geologist and environmental scientist, was Emeritus Fellow of the Institute of Public Affairs in London. And then it was Dr. Singer. He's chairman of the Science Environmental Policy. He was the founder of the IPCC organization. In there, they destroy, well, as far as 97% of scientists agreeing, here's what they say. This claim is not only false, but its presence in the debate is an insult to scientists. They also go on to show how under the Obama administration, scientists were subsidized to the tune of $64 billion to come up with evidence for global warming or climate change. If you gave me $1 million, I think I could come up with some evidence. My question to the professor is, why would these eminently qualified scientists write this recent book, basically destroying the arguments for climate change and global warming and the CO2, along with exposing a lot of the lies of the IPCC?
Mr. Gesick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative. Just a point of note, I'm not a professor at the university. I'm a visiting scholar, so I just want to make sure that's clear for the record. I would care not to think about or speak for the authors and what they have to say on that. What I do know is what I know from my insurance experience, and that the cost of disasters are going up, and that the land use and urbanization and demographic trends are exacerbating that. And so my focus has been on what to do through insurance and public policy partnerships to help mitigate those costs going forward. So that's the evidence I'm working from, and I think I will leave it at that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Gruenhagen, briefly.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for that response. I would simply add that they also reference a petition of over 31,000 American scientists that signed a petition that said there is no convincing evidence that human release of carbon dioxide, methane, or other greenhouse gases is causing or will in the foreseeable future cause catastrophic heating of the Earth's atmosphere. Moreover, there is substantial evidence that increases in atmospheric carbon dioxide.
Representative Gruenhagen, if you could please wrap up, because we have one more question and we have more testimony.
Many beneficial effects on the natural plant and animal environments of the Earth. You know, the forest fires and the building codes were using cheaper materials, which is why you have so much more disaster. And we're mismanaging our forests, which is why we have so many forest fires. That's documented. This is nothing but a big hoax, in my opinion. Thank you.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Say the issue that I have with the ESG scores is that it's simply a form of control where banks, federal government, we've got groups like the World Economic Forum that can control us. And, you know, there are groups right now and credit card companies that are keeping score on how we purchase things. And then MasterCard's actually got kind of a social credit score. So based on how green you are, assigns you a goal. And this is going to lead to financial penalties to people where they're not going to be able to get loans if their personal ESG score is too high. And members, I just don't think this is the route that we want to go. I think it's a panacea. It's the ESG score is just a carrot and a stick that is dangled, and it's a coercive method in order for companies and families in order to bend to the climate change believers of the world. Ms. Gates, would you be willing to answer a couple of questions?
And they'll have to be before Representative Franzen because we're about 5 minutes over for the next section. Ms. Gates, or Representative Franzen, ask your question so we can proceed and maybe ask both of them at once so we can keep pressing on.
Thank you. So I'm curious, as you were talking about ESG scores and on what Allianz is doing for the climate, curious how much carbon was emitted when Allianz built the soccer field, and how much carbon is emitted for those when people are going to and from the soccer field for games?
Ms. Gates.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, I do not have the specific details. What I do know, and I can follow up certainly with more details, is that in the construction of the stadium, environmental impacts were a key lens through which the construction was done. So I know that from a high level. As far as specifics and any carbon footprint attached to it, I'm not familiar with that. I can follow up and see what I can track down on that.
Thank you, Ms. Gates.
One final question. I'm also curious to know how much fossil fuels were used in the building of the field as well. Thank you.
Representative Stevenson, real briefly, and then we got to press on.
Yeah, I was struck by the questions and comments by Representative Franzen. Just wanted to briefly touch, of course, Allianz. I appreciate Ms. Gates' willingness to look into that. They didn't build Allianz Field. They're on the name of it. It's owned by Minnesota United, and it's actually one of the most environmentally friendly stadiums in the world. There's a great article I was looking at. Simple Google search can show you all the environmental considerations that Minnesota United did when they were doing that. But I applaud Allianz for their commitment to this. You know, I was just at a conference, National Conference of Insurance Legislators, where we had a big conversation about the importance of climate and looking at insurance. And so I think Allianz would be irresponsible if they weren't looking at this. And the last thing I just say very briefly, Mr. Chair, is I find it humorous to hear Republicans complaining about private sector companies doing ESG work and saying it shouldn't be done. I thought that party was all about freedom and wanting corporate citizens to be free to do whatever they want, and the marketplace should rule. Well, if the market's moving in a direction they don't like, all of a sudden it's a big problem. It's disappointing to hear that concerns coming from the other side.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Thank you very much to our insurance panel. We're next going to move on to three different speakers, and then we'll have a second round of questions. And first, we are going to hear from Dr. Michaela Krishnan with McKinsey. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Michaela Krishnan. I'm a partner with the McKinsey Global Institute based in Boston. Thank you for the invitation to join you for this testimony. I'm going to share a screen with my presentation. If you could bear with me a moment while I pull it up.
We can see it. Great.
Great. Great. So just as context before I dive in, we've seen globally momentum rising towards net zero and increasingly commitments, as we talked about in the previous session as well, across both companies and countries towards net zero targets. However, what we also know is that commitments on paper, translating those to actions on the ground, is extremely challenging. And so the research that we did, which we launched in January of this year, sought to understand the nature and magnitude of the economic shifts to get us to net zero to help inform stakeholder action. So I look forward to discussing the findings of that research with you here today. First, just a quick disclaimer before I proceed. This summary is provided for informational purposes only. McKinsey & Company does not provide legal, regulatory, or policy advice. So advice of appropriate counsel should be sought prior to taking any action with respect to the legal and regulatory issues that may be relevant to this analysis. So with that, just diving in, to begin with, let's understand the scale of the shifts that we're talking about. As one illustration, we've looked at it with regards to emissions reductions. The top line, the blue line here, is a McKinsey, what we call a McKinsey reference case. It's a forward-looking scenario of viable outcomes on emissions reductions based on line of sight that we have globally on technology evolution, price reductions, et cetera. Think about it as a forward-leaning case on potential emissions reductions. The dashed line, on the other hand, represents where we need to be if we are to achieve net zero by 2050 and restrict warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. There's many different pathways we can take to do this, but one illustrative pathway is cutting global emissions by about half by 2030 and reaching net zero by 2050. And so what we see from this chart immediately is that there's a substantial bending of the emissions curve that needs to occur if we are to reach that net zero target. And at present, we are not, we're not yet at line of sight to get to that net zero goal. And so what our research wanted to do was to try and understand what we need to get to net zero. And it's not surprising that we're far from that goal, just because several elements would need to come together to help us solve this net zero equation. There's a set of things that we call physical building blocks. This is, for example, technological innovation, scaling up supply chain support infrastructure. There's a set of what we call economic and societal adjustments. This is deploying capital at the scale and in the places that it's most needed, managing some of the socioeconomic impacts of a transition, et cetera. And then finally, a set of commitments and enabling mechanisms, governance, standards, tracking mechanisms that we need to ensure that we are on track to get us to net zero. So the focus of our research was really the second category of economic and societal adjustments, to understand how much economies would need to transform and the implications for countries and companies as they undertake that transformation. So to do that, we looked at economic shifts across a range of different variables. We looked at implications on demand for different sectors, costs, capital allocation, jobs. We did that for about sectors that produce 85% of overall emissions in 69 countries. I should emphasize that this analysis is not a projection or a prediction. It's a scenario-based simulation to understand what it would take to get us to net zero. And to do that, we used a scenario from a set of central banks called the Network Greening the Financial System as an input into our work to understand the nature and magnitude of these economic shifts. And what that essentially revealed is six different characteristics of the net zero transition. I'll talk about some of these in more detail as we go through. But the reason understanding these characteristics is important is because once we understand the nature and magnitude of the shifts, we can put in place the right mechanisms to manage the transition so that it is a relatively more orderly rather than a relatively more disorderly transition. That was really the objective of understanding the nature of these shifts. So the first thing that we found is that the transition is universal. You see one example of that on this slide here, where we've looked at a set of energy and land use systems, everything from power to industry to mobility, that contribute to emissions today. This is the global view. It's a similar view for the US, with some of the bubbles sizes looking different, but it's essentially this set of seven energy and land use systems and a set of greenhouse gas emissions across these different systems. And what you essentially see from this chart is that across each of the columns, there's no column where there isn't a large size bubble, which essentially means that each of these systems contributes to some degree to global emissions. And so decarbonizing and reaching net zero will require a transformation of each and every one of these systems. This needs to be a universal exercise across the whole of the economy, across the sectors and countries that participate in each of these systems as well. So this is a whole of economy shift. The second characteristic we identified is that it is significant. And as one illustration, we looked at the scale of spending that we need to incur for the transition to take place. During the transition, we find that annual spending on physical assets would rise to an average of about $9.2 trillion over the next 30 years. We're spending about $5.7 trillion today on these seven energy and land use systems. Think about this as spending on internal combustion engine-based cars or on fossil-based power assets. But that 5.7 would need to be scaled up to 9.2. That's a $3.5 trillion increment over the next 30 years if we are to reach this net zero goal. We also considered an alternate scenario where accounting for policies that governments have committed to, accounting for increase in spending from economic growth, from income growth, from population growth, what that step up of spending would be relative to that scenario. And even then, we found the step up of spending would be less, but still substantial at about $1 trillion per year. So depending on which counterfactual you look at, it's either $1 to $3.5 trillion of step up of spending. The spending would also need to be in fundamentally different parts of the economy if we are to get to net zero. So today of that $5.7 trillion, about 65% goes towards high emitting assets. So again, things like internal combustion engine-based vehicles or fossil-based power. To get to net zero, that number would need to be exactly reversed. And over the next 30 years, about 30% of spending would go towards high emissions assets in this scenario, 70% towards low emissions assets, things like electric vehicles or renewable-based power. So not only do we need to scale spending, we also need capital to be deployed in different parts of the economy to different assets if we are to get to this net zero goal. And that spending is not even. We find that in the early years of the transition, we need to spend more as a share of GDP. Today, we spend about 6.8%. That would rise to about 9% by 2030 before falling back down. This has been said in other ways when we talk about the net zero transition, that the next decade is decisive. And this is another illustration of that, where a lot of the spending would need to be upfront to get us to that net zero goal. It is an uneven transition. It is uneven across geographies, across sectors, across communities. And you see one illustration of that. We find that if you look at the overall GDP in an economy, about 20% of that GDP is produced by sectors that have the highest degree of exposure. By exposure, we mean they need to make the most substantial shifts if we are to get to net zero. This is either parts of the economy that directly emit themselves or who produce products that contribute to emissions. And so the transformation required, whether it's in terms of changing business models, changing the nature of products, rethinking operations, would be most substantial in this 20% of the economy. Another example of unevenness is when we think about jobs. What we found, again, this is a global picture, but what we found is that by 2050, this scenario that we've modeled would lead to about 200 million job gains, 185 million job losses. Now, those numbers are actually lower than some of our other research that has examined things like the role of automation and its impact on jobs. But the challenge with this, the net zero transition, is that the nature of this is a very reallocative transition. It's going to require reallocation of jobs across sectors, potentially across geographies as well, which would mean that for workers, the transition would need to be managed when we think about things like reskilling or the need for economic diversification. The fifth feature is the fact that it's exposed to risk. There's a multitude of short-term risks that will need to be managed, everything from challenges with supply constraints, price volatility as high-emitting assets are ramped down, low-emitting assets are ramped up, issues to do with labor market dislocations, stranded assets. I won't go into each of these in detail, happy to discuss this further in Q&A, but all to say that as we embark on this journey, it's important to think about risks that could mean the transition is more disorderly, either because it's more delayed or abrupt, or because we don't put in place the right mechanisms to manage the transition effectively. And so it's important for stakeholders to also understand the nature of these short-term risks. And then finally, for all the challenges that I've described, it's also important to remember that these expenditures, these costs, are not just costs alone, they're actually investments. Many of these investments actually come with a financial return and create opportunities for companies. And we identify a whole range of opportunities in our research. Some of these opportunities come from decarbonizing existing products and processes. Decarbonization actions, for example, around energy efficiency actually lead to a reduction in operating costs. Some of these opportunities are around entirely new products and markets that get created for low emissions products. And then the third category of opportunities is the entire ecosystem that needs to be built around a net zero economy. For example, to provide the right inputs to supply chains or services such as entirely new financial products, risk management services. So there are a range of opportunities that we see for companies across different sectors from this net zero transition. So finally, I'll just end with this slide, which is a set of considerations for stakeholders as they look towards driving this transition forward in as orderly a manner as possible. These are example considerations, certainly not specific advice, but the types of actions to consider would include building capabilities to assess risks and opportunities in a world where the pathway to net zero is uncertain. It's important to build that muscle to do scenario-based planning and modeling. Armed with that, stakeholders can develop decarbonization plans There are a set of governing standards, tracking and market mechanisms, as we've talked about, that need to be established to ensure that our measurement of emissions, our definition of what net zero means, all of that is well defined. Climate-related factors and transition-related factors need to be integrated into key decisions. So for companies, this means things like integrating it into capital planning, into operations, into risk management, into strategy. Support programs for workers and lower-income consumers that may be disproportionately affected. And then the need for greater collaboration and convening across stakeholders to share best practices, deploy capital at scale, and set some of these standards. So with that, I'll stop my presentation and thank you for the opportunity to share our research. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And our final two speakers for this morning are Dr. Peter Howard and Justin Gunlatch, who are respectively the economics director and the senior attorney for the Institute for Policy Integrity at NYU School of Law. So I will turn it over to both of you to introduce yourself and proceed.
Can you see my screen fine?
Yes, I can.
Great. So I'm the economics director at the Institute for Policy Integrity. I'm going to be talking about the social cost of carbon today. What is the social cost of carbon? It's the external cost to society of emitting an additional unit of CO2 emissions into the atmosphere. It's traditionally calculated with something called an integrative assessment model, which integrates a simple climate model and a simple economic model together. It has four components. It has an emissions scenario, which you plug into a simple climate model, which produces a temperature change. You then plug that into a damage function that gives you a loss of GDP. And then you run the model, as you can see on the right, one time with a baseline scenario. You get a damage impact. You then run it again with one additional unit more of CO2 emissions, as you can see the CO2 pulse. You get a difference in damages. You use your discount rate, which allows you to translate damages over time into a current value. And then you get what's called the social cost of carbon. The interagency working group on the social cost of carbon was founded in 2010 during the Obama administration to create a uniform estimate after a court case ruled that in federal cost-benefit analysis, you couldn't use a zero number. So they took the three most prominent integrative assessment models, one including DICE, which won William Nordhaus the Nobel Prize in economics. They then took five socioeconomic scenarios, which average about to current policy state. They then replaced the equilibrium climate sensitivity parameter to look like match the distribution at the current IPCC values. And they took three discount rates from consumption. The central rate was 3% at the time. And they ran the models 10,000 times for each assumption and got a distribution of 150,000 runs, which they then created three distributions. For the central distribution of a 3% discount rate, they came to a value of $51, which is now what the current federal government is using. Now, the National Academy of Sciences reviewed this methodology in 2016 and gave it a thumbs up at the time. But in 2017, they created a roadmap for improvement. And I'm going to talk about a little bit of what that roadmap now implies for estimates. So the first thing that they mentioned was that the National Academy of Sciences recommended to develop the most likely emission scenario looking out 300 years. And so why 300 years? Well, the reason they recommended 300 years was because at current discount rates, impacts that far out matter to the current climate. Okay, and then they said, well, you know what? You need to calculate this on the most likely scenario using the most likely policies. Okay, so RFF, which is called Resources for the Future, has looked at that, and they recently released a report. And what they find is the black line in the center is the best estimate of emissions, but you can see the gray areas, that's the uncertainty. And so there's a lot of uncertainty, but actually the central estimate looks really close to what the interagency working group did, at least in the first 100 years. So what that says is that actually updating the scenario is not going to have a huge impact on the social cost from what the federal government did in the past. In terms of the climate model, they just recommended an improvement in the simple climate model, and then also recommended that it reflects the best up-to-date science in the IPCC. Note that the in last year, a new IPCC report came out for the climate science. One of the parameters that they talked about was the equilibrium climate sensitivity parameter, which is the amount of warming you get for a doubling of the CO2 relative to the pre-industrial period. And it's actually interesting to find that in the latest report, it actually hasn't changed that much. So that wouldn't have a lot of impact. But they did mention that there should be more focus on short-run warming parameters, and they actually recommended a new model called the FAIR climate model to be used. Third, they did talk about damages, and it should be noted that the current models actually are pretty out of date and are missing a lot of impacts. So for instance, in agriculture, the damages are quite low relative to the current consensus on agriculture impacts. And that's actually counting for CO2 fertilization. So the current models actually are picking up on benefits as well. So that's accounting for benefits. They're still too low. The damages should be quite higher. There's also a lot of omitted impacts like wildfires, ocean acidification, conflict, which has been demonstrated to increase with climate change and warming temperatures, other socioeconomic drivers, and socioeconomic and environmental tipping points. There's been multiple new threads of literature, which I mentioned at the bottom of the slide, but the main point of all these new threads of literature and improved methodologies is they're all pointing to large damages. And you can see a survey that we conducted of about 300, approximately 300 economists publishing the top economic journals, and they're predicting estimates far higher than the 0 to 2% that the models that were used by the government were using, something closer in the 5 to 8% range, and even more, potentially even higher. In terms of the discount rate, new research has come out showing that the strong support for the decision to use the consumption discount rate, it's pretty clear that the consumption discount rate is the appropriate rate, that the capital rate is not appropriate in the cases of intergenerational problems. In addition, actually, a lot of evidence the discount rate has been declining. In particular, the market rate has declined from what was 3% in the 1970 to 2000 to about 2% or lower recently in market rates. This is on the right side. You can see a graph of market rates, of discount rate schedules that were estimated using market rates. And you can see a shift down from 3% to 1%. New rate's actually more like 1% to 2%, and that's being driven by the fact that people are living longer, but they're not retiring. They're retiring about the same age, so they're actually saving more, and that's resulting in a push down internationally on the discount rate. This is confirmed by surveys of economists and is also recent economic theory. So just to give you an idea on resources for the futures, new report actually does a lot of these improvements except for the new damage function and finds an estimate close to about $168. With higher damages, you definitely get above an estimate of $200. And so the key takeaway here is the current IDWG estimates of $51 should be considered a lower bound at the 3% rate. And I'm going to let my colleagues speak more about specific issues at the state level.
Mr. Penlitz.
Thank you. Let's share my screen. All right. Can you see the slide?
Can. It's a little small, but we can see it.
Yes. Is it? Uh-oh. Sorry. Well, I don't have too many details on there. So if something is obscure, please flag it for questions. Thank you all for the chance to present today. As Peter said, my name is Justin Dunlock. I'm a senior attorney at the Institute for Policy Integrity, and my work focuses on state level law and policy relating both to energy and climate change. Now that Dr. Howard has described some of the components of the social cost of carbon, so how the mechanism works and what the latest research indicates about how they should be specified, I am going to talk a bit about how the SCC is applied by state governments. States shown here all use social cost of carbon that is either identical to the Federal Interagency Working Group's SCC or nearly so. Each of these states has applied the SEC to at least one form of decision or analysis. Some have done so for several. Here's some examples. Policy planning is one category of application. Multiple states use the SEC for economy-wide or sectoral policy planning, that is, to value the damage that would be done or avoided as a result of policy alternatives that have emissions implications. So in Maine and Maryland, but I think also in Minnesota, they used the SEC to estimate the value of deploying more distributed solar. In New Jersey, they used it to value a land use component, an energy master plan, or a variety of others. Another example, valuing electricity sector projects. Virginia law, for instance, requires proposals to develop new electricity generation facilities to include an estimate of emissions impacts, whether positive or negative, based on the SEC. In New York, a state agency recently used the SEC to estimate some of the benefits of proposed transmission lines. Another category, valuing and compensating zero emissions electricity. Illinois followed New York's lead and established a zero emissions credit program, or ZEC program, for nuclear power plants. That program compensates the plants for the clean energy attribute of each emissions-free unit of energy generated. So someone else buys the electricity, the program compensates for the cleanness of that electricity. The state legislature in Illinois specified that the social cost of carbon should be used to inform that value, that is the value of the ZEC. Last category that I'll list here is investments in procurement. Washington State recently published it's a spreadsheet, but really a rubric for life cycle cost analysis that can be used when assessing new buildings or gut renovations in terms of energy use and emissions impact that uses the SEC to capture benefits and costs. Those examples are illustrative, of course. They are not exhaustive. There are many others. Now that slide you had a peek of before, three states of those that use the SEC have directed their agencies to use a discount rate lower than the IWG's recommended 3% for the central estimated value of emissions. In Colorado and Washington, the legislatures prescribed that lower rate. In New York, it was the result of a pair of agencies conducting research that recommended or yielded the recommendation of 2%. And you heard some of that from Dr. Howard already. The impact of a lower rate is significant. The difference of just 1% or even 0.5% really can be quite meaningful. This graphic was part of the cost analysis that New York's Energy Research and Development Authority conducted to evaluate that transmission project I mentioned. That project would bring renewable resources directly to New York City. It would displace a lot of polluting generation. And this graphic shows the difference that you get when using either a 2% or 3% discount rate to evaluate the monetized amount or the monetized value, of carbon emissions. And as the years progress, you see how it grows a bit, but the point here is just a meaningful gap between the two. Similarly, this one comes from Virginia, where they examined electric vehicle deployments. The red numbers here show the difference in benefits estimated resulting from just a 50 basis point reduction in the SEC discount rate. In Minnesota, to get permission from the Public Utility Commission to recover the costs of an investment, utilities that operate there must submit integrated resource plans. I expect that term is familiar to some of you. This is for electricity sector stakeholders to review and for the commission to either approve or reject. Those plans include estimates of various costs and benefits. And since the 90s, Minnesota law has said that one type of costs that applies to utilities is environmental costs. Minnesota law also directed the PUC to, and I'm quoting here, quantify and establish a range of environmental costs associated with each method of electricity generation. Climate change is one such cost, and so when utilities file an IRP with the commission, they need to quantify the volume of climate damaging emissions that arise from the proposed investments and operations. And they have to use the social cost of carbon that the commission prescribed in order to translate that quantity into a cost. Like the other 12 states that you saw in that earlier slide, Minnesota mostly relies on the IWG's approach to valuing emissions, but Minnesota's value excludes discount rates below 3%. So since 2016, when an ALJ recommended using a modified version of the IWG's social cost of carbon, ongoing research, as Dr. Howard has described, has led current thinking farther away from that modification that was adopted in Minnesota and suggested that 3% rate is too high. Recent research as you just heard, suggests that the federal IWG's underestimate, that the federal IWG's SCC underestimates the cost of emissions. Minnesota currently directs utilities to use an even lower value, so an underestimate of an underestimate. As I quickly illustrated with those graphics from New York and Virginia, this difference is significant, and in some circumstances is likely to tip the balance in favor of a given project portfolio. That is the end of my presentation. I tried to rush through for the sake of time. I hope I didn't garble too much. I look forward to your questions.
Thank you so much. A lot of good content. The through line I'm hearing from our presenters is the importance of making sure that we are estimating costs accurately and that we are integrating those costs into our decision making. And I want to thank Dr. Krishnan for the very helpful presentation, looking at what the importance of that decision making is. For Mr. Howard and Mr. Gunlatch, I'm hoping you can put into human terms a little bit what the discount rate means. It's I think an economic term that not everybody would be familiar with, but as I characterize it, it's how much we're valuing future generations, essentially, and whether we are discounting future generations more or less when we're trying to make current decisions. And so if you could maybe describe a little bit what the policy choice is between those different discount rates. Mr. Howard.
Yeah, so the way to think about a discount rate really is it's really the trade-off of money and value over time and how we as human beings actually make decisions. So most people, if given a dollar now or a dollar in the future, would just take a dollar now because it's worth more now. And there's a cost to waiting a year. And so the discount rate would be how much you would have to wait, how much you would have to receive to make you indifferent between receiving the dollar now or in the future. Likewise, so discount rates moving the other direction, saying, okay, if you received a dollar in the future, how much would you have to receive now to be indifferent? So like 98 cents. When you get into intergenerational problems, it gets a little bit more complicated, like climate change, because we don't have intergenerational assets. There is some housing loans that exist in other countries, such as Singapore, that have been shown to have what's called a declining discount rate schedule, and have shown that there are much lower discount rates potentially as the future. There is evidence, actually, in the market. But we have very limited evidence in the market of intergenerational assets. And so in that sense, we have other ways to think about that. And that's what we're talking about, weighing the future generations. And those come down to ethical considerations, but there's been a lot of economic theory, actually, and thinking over the last 20 years about this, and we have much more stronger, clearer reasons to believe that the discount rate is lower, particularly given the uncertainty that we face over discount rates and ethical decisions. Thank you for the question.
That's
I'd like to chime in just to say very quickly.
Please do, Mr. Gunlatch.
Those three states I flagged as having lower rates all adopted those rates very recently. So this is the result of legislatures, agencies looking to updated research and reflecting that in policy. In other states, for the most part, the 3% or the IWG range that was adopted earlier.
Thank you. And as you've noted, Minnesota, even though it did adopt earlier, didn't go fully even with the standard recommendation in excluding its 2.5% discount rate when our Minnesota Public Utilities Commission moved forward with our estimates. So that results in a range that is as low as $9 per ton. And I wonder if you could put that in contrast to what some of the best evidence shows now for the more appropriate range based on the research that you've done.
Yeah, so there's two things I would say right off the bat, which is like when Minnesota said it, they chose that upper range, which was 5% on the discount rate. When we did an expert elicitation of in 2015, where we surveyed economists and we did a large number, and then we updated it in 2021. But in the 2015, we found very strong evidence of a discount rate around 2%. Similar to actually another survey that was done on experts on discount rates done by English colleagues. And they found something very similar. And what we also find is not many experts support discount rates above 3%. 5% is maybe in the 10th percentile, 90% though. So it's really up there. And more evidence has been building on the justifications for given for the 5% have started to be kind of undermined as economic theory has progressed. And it's very technical, and we have a report. If people aren't interested, I could share it. And then the last thing I would say is that just, you know, National Academy of Sciences made very clear in 2017 that 100 years is just not sufficient, particularly as the discount rate goes down. So you just can't use something that low. And so the new estimates, the government estimates were $51, but those were really actually estimated in 2013 and then have been progressed. They were updated in 2016, but they essentially adopted the same numbers. The Biden administration essentially just reinstated the old numbers. So they're going through a process right now of updating those numbers. And the new research, as I demonstrated, shows something closer to probably $200, if not slightly more, if you took all of the best evidence into account. Now, again, there's a lot of variability there, right? So there's a lot of uncertainty, but I will note that uncertainty doesn't mean less action. It actually, in economic terms, means more action, because you want to actually be more cautious when you're making an irreversible decision. This is actually shown pretty clearly in investment decisions. So when private companies make decisions to make an investment, they actually account for this uncertainty as well. And it's called option value. So it actually should be more caution, not less.
Thank you. Dr. Krishnan, one question for you, and highlighting the need to integrate climate-related risks into decision-making. I'm curious if there are other examples that McKinsey has seen around the world, either in the private sector or public sector, that you might recommend.
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe a couple of examples in the private sector and then a couple in the public sector. So I think in the private sector, we're starting to see this integration across various forms of business decisions. So companies, for example, as they evaluate their strategy, thinking about the nature of their business. If I'm an automotive company, what is my expectation on how long internal combustion engine-based cars are viable relative to something like electric vehicles? What is the pace with which I change my business model? What does that mean for my supplier decisions, for the capabilities that I hire, for my R&D portfolio? So that's just one very tangible example of how an entire business model transformation relies on integrating a net zero transition into your decision-making. For countries, for city governments, federal and local governments, the parallel is also true. So as countries think about navigating the net zero transition, there's a range of considerations around how do you factor a net zero economy into urban planning decisions? What does this mean for our city layouts, for building codes, for transit systems? There are implications for the types of economic development programs to institute across geographies. Where do I expect demand to exist across different sectors, and how do I scale my workforce appropriately towards that? There's also, as we talked about in the previous session, how to think about physical risks and integrating that into planning decisions. So across both decarbonization as the first, managing transition exposures and how economies are affected by net zero transformation. And then finally, thinking about physical risks, each of these three would affect a whole range of decisions for city and federal governments.
Thank you so much. Well, I'm not seeing additional hands, so I want to just thank our panel for a really excellent presentation and very helpful information. Members, that's all we have on the agenda for today. So thank you for joining us, and we are adjourned.